This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Someone when they have that revelation,
that maybe looking at this case, it could be an interesting process piece.
Okay.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We've got a lot going on today, including work by a dissident writer from North Korea, and the lessons in love that a young man learned from Motown. But we're going to start with one of the most bizarre events in the rise of Donald Trump, the infamous Russian dossier. It's a collection of memos written by former British spy Christopher Steele, who was working on contract for an opposition research company. But this wasn't the typical opposition research that candidates do on each other to dig up dirt. The dossier alleges a ring of corrupt ties between Trump and powerful Russians, so significant that Christopher Steele brought this information to the FBI. After the dossier was published, Steele went into hiding, and he's been attacked relentlessly by conservative media and prominent Republicans as a tool of the Clinton campaign, a purveyor somehow of fake news about a fake scandal, possibly even a criminal. Jane Mayer, a staff writer at The New Yorker, has just published a profile of Christopher Steele. And she found that the dossier wasn't even the whole of what he found out about Donald Trump and Russia. Jane, let's start with one point in your article that has gotten a lot of attention, and that is the idea that there's another Christopher Steele memo written after the election in which it's alleged that the Kremlin somehow tried to intervene and block Trump's initial choice for Secretary of State, Mitt Romney. Take us through that memo and how this allegation is supposed to have played out.
Right. So there is, it was the missing memo from Steele, and it was written at the very end of November 2016. And it's just, it's unusual for his memos because it's really short and it's only based on one source. And his source is just someone who's describing what the talk is in the Russian foreign ministry. And what he says is that people there were claiming credit for trying to intervene and stop Trump from picking Mitt Romney as Secretary of State.
Well, how could they possibly have done that? In other words, there was a lot of opposition to Mitt Romney in the administration to the degree to which Kellyanne Conway went on television and spoke for the Republicans who were against somebody like Romney, who I guess they thought was too much of a globalist. So what did the Russians have to do with any of that?
Well, so it doesn't prove a thing. I mean, it's simply saying this is what they were talking about. And the reason it's interesting and, you know, maybe in some kind of far out way, possibly true, who knows, you know, you need a lot more information, but is that the sort of the situation surrounding it kind of fits the crazy conspiracy theory for a change. And if you take a look at what happened, what's interesting is that Romney did eventually get rejected, and the choice was Rex Tillerson instead, who was kind of a surprise, and as we write, a happy surprise in Moscow at that point, because he had very warm and longstanding ties to the Russian government. He'd been at ExxonMobil, where they had done a huge oil deal with Rosneft, the Russian oil company.
So I wanted to get that point on the boards, but I really want to start from the beginning. Let's begin with, who is Christopher Steele? What's his experience? And why is he looking into any potential Russia-Trump relations in the first place?
So Christopher Steele is someone who spent most of his career at MI6 as a Russia area expert for the British Intelligence Service. He was there for over 20 years. And after that, he left in 2009 and set up his own small business selling intelligence to private clients. And he's considered quite expert by most other people I interviewed in the area of post-Soviet Russia.
So who initially hired him to look into Donald Trump and Russia?
Fusion GPS, which is a Washington firm that provides intelligence also for pay to clients.
But in fact, wasn't there a Republican, Paul Singer, a finance guy who was very much in the establishment of the Republican Party, also interested in relationships between Trump and Russia as a way to, you know, combat the Trump candidacy early on?
Right. I mean, and this is one of the things that suggests there was kind of a bipartisan beginning to this whole research project. Fusion GPS first worked for Paul Singer through a corporation he set up that's called the Free Beacon. And so the first funding came from the right. It came from a Republican who was unhappy with Trump. And when it looked like Trump was going to get the nomination, Paul Singer dropped out, gave up. And Fusion GPS, which had been doing the research, had come across a number of really hot leads, they thought. And so they then went across town, got in touch with the Clinton campaign and said, would you like us to keep digging? We think we're coming up with some interesting stuff.
Is there anything sleazy about that? Is that just the way Washington works these days?
You know, I mean, I think it's the way a lot of the world works. I mean, these companies are not, they're not political. They are commercial enterprises, and they're going to work for almost anyone who will pay them to do the research. And so, you know, they're not like journalists or political figures. They are just companies making a profit.
Do you have any sense of who his sources in Russia are? What kind of people? How high?
Well, he describes them in kind of general terms in most of these reports. And so they range from everything from top former Kremlin officials and former FSB agents to people who worked in, for instance, the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Moscow. It seems to be a whole range of people.
And why do we trust him? Why, you know, your piece, if there's an overwhelming tone to it, it's one of that this guy has great credibility in intelligence circles, but also in government circles. Why do you trust him?
Well, I certainly wouldn't do it on blind faith. I mean, what this piece does is goes back and interviews people who've worked with him and known him really throughout his whole life and who know his whole record professionally. And it also talks to intelligence officials about the dossier and how it stands up over time. And what comes through in the reporting is he has an excellent reputation. He's considered a reliable source by the U.S. government, by both the intelligence agencies and the FBI, who've worked closely with him over the years. He's considered reliable by MI6, where he worked for over 20 years, and he's considered to be reliable by the clients who've hired him as his private business. And so he brings with him a sort of a sterling reputation, basically. And, you know, the dossier, I think you also have to understand what it is. And a lot of the intelligence people that I interviewed talked about it. If you're expecting it to be 100% accurate, I think you're going to be disappointed. What it is basically raw intelligence. It's conversations with well-informed sources who are saying what they're hearing. It hasn't been corroborated or cross-checked with other kinds of intelligence, which is what a finished intelligence report would be. It's just the first stage of an intelligence report.
Now, it's pointed out in the piece that Steele is in the position of being hated by both the president of Russia and the president of the United States, Putin and Trump. So give us a sense of what the last year has been like for Steele. And how do you know, by the way?
Well, it's been incredibly hard for him, is the answer. He has talked to friends. My life is never going to be the same, is what he tells people. And how do I know it? Well, one of the greatest sources in the story is his business partner, Christopher Burroughs, with whom he set up the business in 2009. It's a small shop, fewer than 10 employees. They work closely together every day. And Burroughs, for the first time, has really revealed what it's been like for them and told me what Steele's been saying. And so did many of Steele's old friends, because I got the ability to talk to an awful lot of people who've known him over the years.
One of the things that Steele investigated in his career recently is the way that that Litvinenko was poisoned to death by Soviet agents. At least that was the conclusion he came to, Alexander Litvinenko. In fact, there's no news of yet another Russian agent living in London who seems to be dying of poisoning, possibly by Russian infiltration. That suggests that Christopher Steele himself might be in great danger. Does Steele think that he is in mortal danger?
You know, he doesn't, from what I've heard, act like somebody who thinks he's in mortal danger. He did initially, when the news broke of who he is and that he was the author of this dossier, he fled with his family for about 8 weeks and went into hiding. But he's now back and walking the streets of London. He tries to keep a very low profile and just do his work.
Is he protected by British authorities?
He is not, no. And I think the theory that he has shared with his partner is that the Russians generally, you know, they may go after their own in places as far-flung as London, but they don't generally go after the opposing country's intelligence services.
Now, this piece is hardly a puff piece on Christopher Steele. You have people who are his critics, not only in the present tense, but when he was in college, and also people describe him as having a Marmite personality. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, he has a – Marmite is this very sort of salty spread that the British put on toast sometimes. Either you love it or you hate it. And he has had that effect on people throughout his life. He's a very black and white person who has a very binary view of what's right and what's wrong, and a very strong sense of this is my duty and I must do it. And, you know, some people find it to some extent kind of naive. You know, at one point, one of the people he talked to said that he would sort of describe the goodies versus the baddies. And the baddies were the Russians and the goodies were the West. With the, you know, which included, in his view, the United States. And so I think when I say he's naive, what I mean is he sort of had a view of the U.S. government as being somewhat enlightened and not necessarily throwing somebody like Christopher Steele under the bus in order to sort of push their partisan political agenda.
So there's an amazing moment in your piece, Jane, when Glenn Simpson, who's one of the co-founders of Fusion GPS, the firm that Steele was working for and doing the investigation for, and Simpson said in congressional testimony that, quote, "We threw a line in the water and Moby Dick came back." Did Steele know what he was getting himself into when he decided to look into Trump's connection to Russia? And when they did bring Moby Dick back, what did he do next?
Well, and this is, you know, to me, one of the major moments in the story, too. What's so interesting is that he didn't even think really about what he was getting himself into in the beginning. So he goes ahead, he gets this information, he thinks it's going to be an assignment to look into just, you know, a few sort of ordinary dodgy business deals involving Trump and Russia. And his network is tasked to bring back what they can find. And lo and behold, what comes back is utterly shocking.
So what is shocking? We know the one indelible piece of business in the dossier, which was eventually published by BuzzFeed, was that Trump at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in his room at the presidential suite allegedly had paid prostitutes to urinate on the bed. But the dossier and the many memos that comprise it have many other details. What are the most salient ones? What are the most believable and what are the most problematic for the Trump administration?
Well, so I have to say, to Steele, what he's looking at is not just the act itself, but the possibility that a future president of the United States could be blackmailed, and that that could possibly explain a lot of the pro-Russian positions that Trump is taking. What he's also looking at is that the first report comes, it's written up in the end of June in 2016 by him, and it also looks at what he says is his sources say is at least a 5-year courtship by the Russians of Trump, and that they have a sort of this relationship going back over years where the Russians are feeding Trump and the people around him intelligence that on his opponents, including Hillary Clinton, and offering dirt on her in particular, and that they're backing Trump in the election in particular, and that they're going to try to do this in exchange for eventually trying to get some policy changes that they want from the United States, including lifting sanctions.
So just to be clear, the funding for Steele's work, which is controversial, that all came from private sources, right? But he then brought the results of his investigation to the FBI out of a sense of national security. Am I getting it right?
That's right. So this has been something that's been misportrayed by Trump's defenders, basically. They've suggested he went to the FBI in order to start up the current so-called witch hunt, as they see it. They claim that what Steele was trying to do was take opposition research that was phony to begin with and start an FBI investigation into Trump in order to blacken his name. What was the reality? Well, the reality is that he did this voluntarily. He did it for free, and he did it out of a sense of duty that he'd acted on in many times in the past.
So he gives this dossier to the FBI in 2016 in July. How did the FBI react? Was the FBI already looking into Trump themselves?
So he doesn't actually give them the dossier. He just does a briefing on July 5th, 2016. One of the FBI agents he knows comes by his office in London. And apparently the reaction, Steele has said elsewhere, was shock and horror. But it seemed like as the weeks went on, the FBI really didn't do much about it. I was told it was summertime. People are on vacation. Meanwhile,
wait a minute. Are you kidding me? The FBI didn't brief anybody because people were in Cape Cod or the Jersey Shore?
It just kind of moseyed along.
So the FBI initially doesn't react in the summer of 2016. Weeks go by. And at this point, Steele and his colleagues at Fusion GPS decide that they're going to try to get some of this information out through other means. And you, among others, were involved. Tell us that story.
I got this kind of mysterious call saying, would you like to meet with a Russian expert? We can't give you his name, but he's going to be over at the Tabard Inn near DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C., and meet us at a certain point. So I thought, well, that's intriguing. So, of course, I went over.
And it's close to the office, so it's not
inconvenient. It's close to the office, and the food's really good there. And so I walk in, and right around a table in a private dining room are people from Fusion GPS and this British man who turns out to be Christopher Steele. And we were told we were not allowed to use his name. We reporters.
How many reporters were there?
Well, it was just me at that point. Mm-hmm. But there were others coming and going all day long, I think. And I was given a briefing by him. And he made a kind of a very strong impression on me because he was tamped down as a person, but he was trying very hard to get across something that you could see he actually really believed strongly in, which was, in essence, that the U.S. was in danger. And he was saying Trump has compromising ties with the Russians, and they are trying to interfere in your election, and they're trying to undo NATO, and they're trying to break up the Western alliance, and this is really serious. Later, when after Trump was elected and more came out about the ties between the Trump team and Russia, and eventually much more came out about the dossier, and he was described as a bad actor by the Trump defenders and someone who was a liar and somebody who was just out to get Trump, it didn't compute with the little glimpse I'd seen of him.
To what degree does this dossier shape the Mueller investigation of the Trump administration?
I don't know. You know, Mueller is a black box. They famously don't leak. It's really hard to know. But what you can see is that there are four members of the Trump team who Mueller has now indicted, and three of them have pled guilty and are cooperating with him. And these are people, several of whom are named in the Steele dossier. So it seems as if there's something beyond just smoke. There's a little bit of fire there, we've seen.
The article, and it's a remarkable one, even though I know I'm prejudiced, is called The Man Behind the Dossier, and the reporter and author is Jane Mayer. Jane, thanks so much.
Thanks, David.
Jane Mayer, a staff writer since 1995 and the author of Dark Money and other books. You can find Jane's article about Christopher Steele at newyorker.com. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Recently on newyorker.com, we published a poem from North Korea, our first. It's called Blizzard, by a writer identified as Bandy. Bandy is the only dissident we know of writing from inside the DPRK. It's an extraordinarily isolated nation, and we know almost nothing about its culture. The New Yorker Radio Hour's Mythili Rao has been writing about the strange circumstances behind Bandy's work.
So here's what we think we know about Bandy. He's believed to be a North Korean writer working as a propagandist for the state. And the story goes that sometime in the 80s or 90s, he started secretly writing fiction that was critical of the regime. There was no way he was going to be able to publish that, so these papers quietly accumulated, hidden away somewhere. Several years ago, a relative of Bandy's told him she was going to defect. She was going to leave North Korea. And at that point, he told her about this manuscript and asked her if she could take it with her. She said that would be far too dangerous in case she was caught, but if she made it across safely, she would try to send back for it. When this relative got to South Korea, she got in touch with a human rights activist who had a lot of contacts along the border, And he was able to find someone who could sneak in and contact Bandy. And the story goes that the manuscript was smuggled out of the country, concealed in a copy of the selected works of Kim Il-sung. The short stories in that manuscript were published first in Korean and then in English under the title The Accusation. And the poems that were also in those crumbling pages are now being translated by a Korean-American scholar named Heinz Insu Finkel. I asked him to read one of the poems. It's called Blizzard.
So this poem is called Blizzard. Blizzard, blizzard, the sound of winter crying, chest pounding, sobbing, the sound of winter crying. Spring, summer, fall, and winter, four seasons and only you, weeping the indignity of your unfortunate fate, never knowing soft flowers, green leaves, ripe fruit, only frost and snow, born of cold north wind, your whole life huddling, cringing, shivering, weeping the indignity of your unfortunate fate. Blizzard, blizzard, the sound of winter crying, chest pounding, sobbing, the sound of winter crying. Try to tear it up, throw it out, your unfortunate fate, running, spewing blood in the sound of winter crying. So in my translation, I tried to get a sense of the rhythmic quality of the Korean. So I'll read you a couple lines of the refrain in the Korean. In Korean, the title is 눈보라. 눈보라, 눈보라. 겨울이 우는 소리. 가슴 치며 흐느끼며 겨울이 우는 소리. So on the surface, that simply sounds like a representation of the harsh winter in North Korea. And anyone who's lived in Korea knows that during the winter, the winds come from the Siberian region, and they're bitterly cold. But it's especially poignant because we know that in North Korea, there's a tremendous amount of labor going on in such harsh conditions.
I wanted to talk a little more about who Bandy is. What do we know about Bandy and his biography?
One thing we know from the nature of the stories and the poems is that he very clearly had the kind of training that a member of the Joseon Writers Alliance would have. The stylistic tricks and the tropes that he uses are very consistent with that kind of literature.
And the Joseon Writers Alliance is the Alliance of North Korean propaganda writers. And what does being a propaganda writer in North Korea entail?
So for a propaganda writer, the writers don't simply sit down and write what comes to their own minds. They're actually given a particular assignment or a particular mission. So for example, the government might say, we need some stories that will help to increase the production of potatoes, or stories that discourage stripping the environment of flowers. And the writer would then be tasked with doing that, and at the same time, including some theme in that story or poem that also glorifies Kim Jong-il or Kim Jong-un. So it's a very difficult task.
Do you see stylistic traces of that kind of propaganda approach to writing in this work?
The poems in general, I guess you would say the layered language. For example, let me see if I can find a good example for you. So yeah, here's one that sort of turns the tables using the same kind of imagery and technique. This one is called Toads, and it says, "The long rains go on, only you toads are thriving. Croak, 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 croak. Dark black clouds, not a spot of sun to see, but still you enjoy it this world this time. Croak, 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 croak. Soaked, bloated by flood, your stylish red bellies, croak, 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 croak. Your asses foam in the muck, your spirits rise. And yes, you enjoy it this world this time. Croak, 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 croak." So that's a pretty explicit and vicious comparison of somebody in political power with a typical Korean toad. The toad is called a menkungi, and it's a fairly common sight. The menkungi type toad is one that will puff itself up, right, so to look bigger than it actually is, And when I was a little kid, we used to find these toads and tap them with a stick, and that would cause them to puff up and their bellies would turn red. So this is the kind of poem that would be very familiar to any Korean. Normally, this form would be used to glorify some political figure or some administrator, but it's being used to turn the tables.
A lot of people are skeptical about Bandy really being a living writer in North Korea. A lot of experts I've spoken with have said it just seems like maybe some part of the story isn't quite what is being presented. Why does it seem plausible to you that Bandy is a living North Korean writer?
So one of the things that makes me think that the manuscript is authentic was Do-hyun's description of how delicate it was.
Do-hyun is the human rights activist.
Yes, and he described it to me, and I was thinking, well, you know, the manuscript is only from the mid-90s, so to an American, it wouldn't make sense that the paper would be so delicate that it would crumble. But if you're familiar with Korean manuscript paper, it makes perfect sense. When I was growing up in South Korea, the manuscript paper that was used, they called it dongjongi, which literally means like dung paper. And it was a very low-grade recycled paper. It was never white. It was like slightly gray. And in North Korea, they still use that. And that paper has such a high acid content that if you just leave it sitting around for 10 years and then fold the page, that page will literally break at the fold. So the description of the manuscript pages made perfect sense to me.
Before we go, do you want to read one more poem?
Okay. So this poem is called My Love. Even from that distance, you flood me with feeling when you meet my eyes. Please, woman, do not tempt me. I have a love that awaits, true to me, pouring forth a fierce devotion. Beaming that smile with your painted lips, please, woman, do not tempt me. I have a love that awaits, to whom I've trusted all my heart. Love is two souls become eternally one. Please, woman, do not tempt me. If in this life we cannot meet, I have a love I must meet in death. So this one is very interesting because on the one hand, the woman who's the temptation could represent democracy and the West and capitalism. And then the other love, the love that awaits, is the hope of reunification. Love is two souls become eternally one. That would be the reunification of the peninsula. So this one is actually, when I was translating it, it actually brought tears to my eyes because it's a real tearjerker.
This imagined perfect love, does that describe a unified regime that follows a North Korean template? I mean, is this a pro-regime poem or is this an anti-regime poem, if you can simplify it that way?
Yeah, that's a tough question because the dream of reunification is seen sort of differently in the North and in the South. So in the old days, from the Kim Il-sung point of view, reunification was the forcible reuniting of the peninsula under the communist regime. These days, the idea is much more diplomatic and suggests a kind of compromise. But I think from the North Korean point of view, the reunification would be a kind of socialist country with less influence from American capitalism. The South Korean idea right now is a much more realistic view. They're expecting a reunification that's much more emotional in terms of, say, families finally being able to reunite. But they understand the reunification process as one that's going to require lots of economic and social sacrifices from the South. But I think the dream of the unified peninsula is actually shared in common, especially by the younger generation. They're much more idealistic about it than people who grew up during the war years.
That's Heinz In-Soo Fenkel, a translator and scholar of Korean culture. He spoke with Mythili Rao, one of our producers. She wrote about Bandy's fiction at NewYorker.com. Still ahead this hour, Vincent Cunningham on the tragic beauty of love according to Motown. That's ahead on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Now, we've talked about the Russia investigation, about North Korea, and I think we can safely turn our attention to other matters. Josh Rothman has written for The New Yorker about just about anything, about philosophy, about fashion, about science, and he recently did a terrific piece about how all the advances in technology have failed to eliminate, wait for it, paper jams from our printers. But among all these interests, one really stands out. Josh says he's never met another man who will admit to reading romance novels. Last year, Josh talked with Curtis Sittenfeld, who's published 5 novels. Now, they're books that involve romance, but they're not exactly romance novels. The most recent is called Eligible, a modern retelling of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. Curtis Sittenfeld asked Josh Rothman the first question.
Can I ask you what your definition of, like, a romantic novel is?
Well, certainly there's lots of classic novels that are essentially romance based.
But I also read
like a reasonable quantity of like Nora Roberts. And
that's what I was curious. So essentially, would you say bodice rippers? Like, is that a fair or is that a derogatory term?
I don't know if that's a I've never read 50 Shades of Grey. And I don't think of Nora Roberts as a bodice ripper type writer. I think there it's still pretty romantic in the sense that, you know, it's mostly about unresolved sexual tension, so to speak, between the protagonists. And it's not quite about sex, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I started reading these books when I was, I don't know, probably 10.
Me too.
Yeah. Like a pre-adolescent or early adolescent kind of experience. And I think I've read actually, you know, probably a zillion romantic novels over the course of my life. I mean, how did this start for you? Like, what was your introduction?
My gateway was Danielle Steele in fourth grade. I read Harlequin romances around sixth grade. And then I read the ones where it's sort of like, you know, the woman has like a blouse that's falling off her shoulders and her cleavage is showing, and the man, which I think Fabio was the model for a lot of these in the 80s or 90s. And they're sort of like intertwined, like whatever you want to give the name to those. Mm-hmm. I amassed a pretty large, I don't know if I'd say a zillion. And I actually do not read those anymore. But I read them for a long time and they were a big part of my life.
And then was there a point where you started writing stories that were about love?
Yeah, I think that I sort of became a person who, I would almost say I wrote more about like awkward hookups more than romance or like unrequited love and yearning. But so it's almost like the flip side of romance, but it's, you know, it's kind of in reaction to romance or like in the neighborhood of romance.
So in Eligible, so a few years ago, you wrote this book, Eligible, which is a a sort of reimagining of Pride and Prejudice that takes place in the modern world. And in Pride and Prejudice, the original, the Austen novel, the moment, I guess you could say, where Lizzie Bennet and Darcy notice each other, what happens is Jane, Lizzie's sister, is sick, and Lizzie has no way to get from her house to the house where Jane is staying. So she runs there, basically. And and when she gets there, she's like breathing hard and maybe a little sweaty and her hair is a little messed up. And she runs into Darcy, and that's when he notices her, I guess. And in Eligible, you came up with the cleverest way to do this in the contemporary context. And I wonder maybe you could just tell that.
Yeah. So Eligible takes place in 2013 in Cincinnati, Ohio, as all the best novels do. And it's summertime. Jane has fainted at lunch and has been taken to the ER. And it's midday in summer in Cincinnati, so it's like 100 degrees. There are no cars at home. And so she thinks, okay, I'm just going to put on my running clothes and run like 5 miles to the hospital. And then my Darcy is a neurosurgeon. And so conveniently, they run into each other outside the entrance to the hospital where she's like sweating everywhere and is totally disheveled.
And as I recall in Eligible, I mean, it's pretty sexy. Like, she's in her running gear. I think she's just in like a sports bra and shorts. And she like runs her hands through her hair and a drop of her sweat flies from her hand and lands on Darcy's white coat. And they both see it happen, but nobody says anything. It's just a little moment of contact, you know, that's like a little...
Well, it's funny... I don't know if that's everyone's definition of sexy. I'm glad to hear it's yours.
So I was at dinner with my wife's family, and I was telling them, oh, you know, I'm going to do this radio interview where I talk about romance novels. And everyone was shocked that this was a thing that I was into. And I discovered, you know, there were no, of course, none of the other men at the table had ever read, so they claimed, a romance novel. But they all read like detective novels or thriller novels. And it occurred to me at that moment that maybe part of the way it works is that it's about familiarity. So unlike you and me, who started reading romance novels when we were small, plenty of guys never did that. And so to them, the pleasure of a new story is relatively small. You actually have to have read a lot of them in order to get a lot of joy out of these stories. You have to be in the habit, and then something about romance comes alive. But anyway, that's my pet theory that I've been mulling over.
Well, I also think that it could have to do with packaging, where I think that, like, and again, these are sweeping generalizations about gender, which are very easy to disprove. But I mean, even like the covers of my books, there's a preppy ribbon belt on one cover. On the cover of Eligible, it's a diamond ring. Mm-hmm. And so I think that telegraphs to men, unfortunately, like, this is probably not for you. Like, I think that plenty of men have the capacity to take the same pleasure in a romantic story or to be moved by it. I don't know, you know, like Braveheart or mm-hmm. The Wire or something. I feel like my readership has been 90% at least female ever since I first started having books published. And I had my first story published in The New Yorker in August 2016. It's about two people who don't really know each other who end up, a shuttle driver and a woman on a business trip, who essentially end up having, like, spoiler alert, like a hookup in a hotel room. And the photo is sort of like the bottom two-thirds of a woman lying in a bed with her legs crossed. So it's like a pretty sexy photo, but it's not feminine. Anyway, I heard from a very disproportionate number of male readers where they were like, I loved your story in The New Yorker, Curtis. And I thought, okay, is it that it was in The New Yorker and The New Yorker is neither male nor female? Is it that the illustration was sexy, but also, you know, not overtly feminine or masculine? Is it that the story itself was kind of sexually graphic that made me have this spike in male readership? But I think above all, I think it was the fact that there's nothing about this that's saying men don't read it. Like, if anything, it's saying, like, men, give us a read. And so it was very – so it's like I think that what we're talking about could really be, like, aesthetic or visual or, you know, have to do with marketing.
That's really, that's fascinating. One sort of like criticism one could make of romantic fiction is that it just ends, there's always a happy ending, first of all, and it always ends with the end of the courtship. What do you think about this thing about romance sort of having a circumscribed temporal dimension where it just sort of ends with the wedding? Did you resist that, or what's your feeling about that?
I didn't resist it in Eligible.
Right.
I almost feel that a romance is one of the few inherent or natural narratives in human existence. You know, being born and dying has a kind of shape, but it's too elongated or like slack or something. But romance is this thing where like it has the structure of a story. You don't have to impose it from the outside.
I guess on some level we're approaching the question of whether romance is real.
Is it a
script?
Yeah.
That people follow? Because I think maybe one thing that's emerging is, for you and me, romance novels are really fascinating because they're true. I mean, like they're about the most interesting part of real life. But if you're not a romance reader, then I think your conception of a romance novel is the opposite, that it's like completely false.
Well, I feel like, I mean, I think anyone who's ever had a crush on someone else would have to say, yes, they are realist. I mean, you know, not all of the details, but it's like, it's not, I don't know. There is a line that I read relatively recently, and I wish I could remember where I read it. It's something like, would people fall in love if there weren't stories about love or songs about love? You know, like, have we all been sort of primed to want this thing? And there's almost like this feedback loop or something.
Another way of saying this is when I was in college, I was a creative writing major, and my teacher was Edmund White. And at one point I'd handed in a bunch of stories. And they were all pretty romantic, basically. They were about couples and things. And he asked me, we were having like a one-on-one meeting, and he asked me, are your parents divorced? And I said, yeah, why? And he said, well, because I find that often my students with divorced parents write the most romantic stories.
Oh.
So, and that's always interesting to me. Like, why is it so fun to read and think about these things, even if... Like, I'm married, I happily so, and have a wonderful romantic marriage and things, but I don't have but my appetite for reading these stories about anguished lovers that can't get together is basically undiminished. And I wonder, like, in your case, why do you think you love these stories so much?
So I guess, I mean, I think the short answer, by the way, I feel like saying I have a wonderful romantic marriage is a very unusual sentence to be uttered aloud. I feel like that should be its own podcast, and it should be like 3 hours long. So I think that the romantic story kind of contains everything. Like, I think that essentially so much fiction is about people acting against their own best interest. And there's this sort of pretense that we're all like, you know, very responsible and almost like trying to be our best selves and wearing Fitbits and like making healthy choices. And like, there's something about, you know, romance that can be so self-destructive, or like you run the risk of like humiliating yourself, or you're so vulnerable. And the fact that it's worth it to people is must mean like it's really great, like that you get to feel really deep feeling, you know, physical and emotional feelings. Like it's almost like you can tell how exciting it is or how gripping it is because of how much people risk for it.
Yeah. If radio listeners out there are driving down the road listening to this and they're passing Barnes & Noble and they can pull into the parking lot right now and buy a romance novel, what should they buy?
Well, okay, can I say two?
Yeah.
my heart is torn between two romance novels. No, so in boarding school I accumulated like essentially a trunk full of bodice rippers. And the only one that I saved was Savage Thunder by, I don't know if you say Joanna or Johanna Lindsay. there's essentially a sex scene that takes place on horseback. okay, so that's one. But then the other thing I would say is read an Alice Munro book, which, I mean, I'm sure plenty of people have. But there's a particular story called Tricks in the collection Runaway. It's like devastating. And I feel like it's taken me almost years to get over it. So it's sort of, I mean, I think it's very romantic and it's very upsetting. Like, it kind of like crushes your heart in the best possible way.
That's totally awesome. Well, thank you so much.
This is so fun. I feel like I almost have like heart palpitations because I'm so excited to be talking about romance.
Curtis Sittenfeld's last novel is Eligible, and she has a collection of stories coming out next month. You think it, I'll say it. She spoke with Joshua Rothman in 2017. We're going to stay on the romance theme for just a minute. Let's say we're making amends for Valentine's Day, which we missed entirely, and I hope you forgive us. Writing about his early love of Motown, staff writer Vincent Cunningham said this: "With all due respect to Smokey Robinson, the Motown sound as we know it was created by Holland, Dozier, Holland. Those three guys were a songwriting team made in heaven. The brothers Brian and Eddie Holland and Lamont Dozier. And they wrote many of the songs that made Motown what it was. Heat Wave, Baby I Need Your Loving, How Sweet It Is, and so many other hits. Vincent Cunningham says those classics from a half century ago still have a lot to teach an impressionable young man today."
My dad was the music director at the churches I went to when I was a kid. And so I was always interested in music. But there was a moment when I decided, like, I was going to know this stuff, right? And I got really into Motown in around the 8th or 9th grade. I want a love I can't see. That's the only kind that means a thing to me. There's a VH1 movie about the Temptations. And it's just a great but bad movie. But the music in it is so beautiful. And the most interesting parts of that movie to me were the parts, the sort of technical parts. They would kind of show all of these great producers and songwriters kind of participating in this Motown laboratory.
The Temptations became part of the Motown machine. Berry Gordy's assembly line approached artist development. We had vocal coaching from Maurice King, and countless sessions in Motown Studio A with the in-house band known as the Funk Brothers.
At the same time in school, I was starting to get more into music. So I was like in Glee Club in school, and later on I took music theory and things like this. So I had a notebook and I would chart, you know, where the chorus came in and how long the verses were and then when the chorus came back, all these kinds of things about the songs to try to understand whether there was, you know, a formula. Part of this sort of weird obsessive personality is then you would look in the sort of liner notes and you would see who wrote this. And I noticed that lots of the ones that I really loved were by this, it would just say Holland, Dozier, Holland. And so I wanted to kind of know more about that. There are these two brothers, Brian and Eddie Holland, and a friend of theirs, Lamont Dozier. And so they developed this process by which they would all kind of crowd around a piano, plunk out some melodies, maybe even give the song a name.
We're going to start this off with a C, okay? We're going to jump to an F.
What I found amazing is that they would create the total master track. Like, what you hear on the song was created before ever a lyric was written. And then they would give it to Eddie, who would then torture himself with it. And then would come the vocals as, like, the sort of last part of the production process. I was, like, so captivated by that there was a science to the things that I experienced as art. And so all the while, as I'm listening to this music, it's impossible also not to learn something about the message that's coming through in these songs. A lot of these songs are very sad, right? You're hearing this very unique vision of love, which is in some ways saying that you kind of are going to come out of it on the other side the worse for wear. And perhaps this is the right time, right? If you're 12 or 13, perhaps this is the exact right time to listen to this music. I certainly did, in some ways, learn these things about love, which I don't know if they're true or not, but I certainly understood what Eddie Holland thought love was, which was this sort of metaphysical entity, right, that was defined by your inability to ever attain it, at least in its perfect form. Standing in the shadows of love, I'm getting ready for the heartaches to come. Can't you see me standing in the shadows? Literally, standing in the shadows of love is about, like, love's dark side, right? Like, that's implied even in the title. And this song is, it's so odd because there's a sort of full vision. He sees the beginning and he also sees the end. But he's just running headlong into this thing that he knows is going to destroy him. A lot of love songs have a kind of almost epistolary quality. You kind of think that it's part of an exchange. Whereas these narrators of Holland, Dozier Hollands are always kind of, in some ways, monologuing. The other person seems kind of remote and mute, and it's this person reaching out and in some ways not getting transmissions back. And I think that kind of matched the person that I was. I was like a very sentimental, romantic kid. Like, I was, like, very quick to cry and longing for, you know, there's this idea of love where you wake up in the morning and you're thinking about someone and you know that they're thinking about you. I mean, if you're like me, you just be purely just pine for it. And in some ways, there was a vicarious thing going on where I just, like, was just hearing how, you know, how it could one day be. I still listen to these songs now, and I don't think that love is quite as bad as they made it out to seem. But I think there is one really important insight, which is that the great fact of any kind of love is the imaginary state of being without that love, or the imaginary state of being without that person. Has made a fool of me. And so I think Holland, Dozier Hollands songs speak of a specific kind of love that is electric and exciting, but the farthest thing possible from a guarantee. But we do it anyway.
Vincent Cunningham is a staff writer at The New Yorker. And that's it for us today. I hope you've enjoyed the show, and I hope you join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio, or sign up for our newsletter so you can always know what we're up to at newyorkerradio.org.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Terrence Bernardo, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Tarina Endowment Fund.